Today, the latest from the property market front line with Chris Bates. Hello again, it's Martin Hill from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by mortgage broker, financial advisor, Chris Bates. Hi, Chris.
G'day, Martin. Good to see you again.
How are you going? It's certainly a busy time, isn't it?
Crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's just extraordinary, really, when you think about the true numbers of people that are affected, you know, whether it's employment, mainly here, but I mean, health all over the world. But you know, it's pretty devastating, really, when I talk to some clients who are, you know, really impacted, or their friends or family, etc. So it is a bit of a scary time. Some are getting through pretty unscathed, but, you know, a lot of people are getting affected, obviously.
Yes, and, you know, my surveys are showing the same. There are definitely some people who are relatively protected and are doing fine, but there are others that are immediately being impacted. But there's a third group who are beginning to realise that they will be impacted later. And it's that third group that I think I'm most concerned about. So, for example, some of those who've got mortgage repayment holidays at the moment, you know, they're recognising that that won't last forever. Those actually in rental accommodation who've had rental payment holidays, but actually they've still got to pay that rent in retrospect. So wherever you look, this has got a way to run, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you break those down, I mean, the JobKeeper, you know, it's great because once you're out of a job, you know, it's much harder to get back into a job, but, you know, it's still not a great policy, I think. It doesn't really just protect the job forever. There's going to be an end to it. And, you know, a lot of businesses will potentially keep you on because it's not really costing them anything. But, you know, when business isn't there to support it, you know, you are going to see a lot of businesses not continue, right? And I think the worrying is the scarring. How, you know, a lot of women, a lot of younger people, you know, and impact of them being out, you know, not able to get a job, and how long is that going to take, the mental health. There's so many issues with unemployment growing and underemployment. I think that's the big thing that, you know, are you going 4 days now? Have you had to take a pay cut? All these sort of things flow in after a, you know, a big sort of impact like this.
No, you're quite right about that. And of course, we've now got, you know, roughly 2.9 million households and people basically being supported by JobKeeper. It was meant to be 6.5. The interesting question is, what's happened to that 3 million, right? And it's not necessarily just a good story that they're back in work. In many cases, some of those smaller firms decided they couldn't actually afford to go through the JobKeeper process because they'd actually have to pay out before they got any money back. And so they basically have just not gone there. And also others have not quite seen enough of a drop in turnover to be able to actually warrant it either. So we've actually got quite a few people who were perhaps expecting to get support and aren't getting support. And I think that's probably a story that the mainstream media really hasn't picked up on yet.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have to have a 30% drop in revenue. And, you know, a lot of businesses, the revenue they're writing today is, you know, what they're, the work they've done in September, October, November, and then finally they're starting to get paid today. And it's very hard to show a drop in revenue instantly because, you know, it's a lag. It's the productivity drops today. It impacts the business in 6 months' time. So I think that plays into it a lot. So there's lots of, I think, issues with the JobKeeper and, you know, potentially people getting more than they were and et cetera. So I think it is masking things. The mortgage payment holidays one is an interesting one. I think there's lots of big stats out there on how many people have, you know, put off their mortgage and wanting 14 borrowers and 10%, or there's lots of stats going around. We're not really sure, you know, if they're all needed to do it. And I think, you know, ANZ have said about 80% have still got the same income. So I think, you know, a lot of banks just did blanket 6 months. You know, you get 6 months without any repayments and zero repayments, which does make you feel like you've got more money, which hopefully you spend in the economy. But some are doing 3 months and then you've got to extend it for another 3 months. And I think when you get to that 3 month mark, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the banks play that, because in the initial round, they just basically gave it to anyone. If you applied, they couldn't do the due diligence on everyone to make sure whether you actually needed it. And so that basically just everyone got it. And I think in this 3 month one, the ones that have just done 3 months like Westpac, it's going to be interesting to see how they play it and if some get declined for the additional 3 months because they say you actually don't need it, you're still earning the same money. And I think that'll bring a much more understanding on how big the payment holiday issue is, because I think not everyone who's delayed is actually in financial stress. They've just done it because they could.
Yeah, I agree. And interestingly, I think about 60% of the households in my survey who got that repayment holiday have had no change in income. So they're looking at it as an opportunistic way of giving us a bit more cash and maybe saving a bit on those things, firstly. Secondly, of course, there's a big difference between those in owner-occupied properties. They're getting the payment holidays, but investment owners are not. And there's been a very low approval for property investors getting those payment holidays.
Yeah, we've seen some mixed results there. We've definitely seen investors get it 100%. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's the issue with the investors is the ones who have bought properties in areas that are going to have problems with vacancy. And those, in, like, for example, high rise apartments. I mean, I know you've been banging on about the building quality issue. I mean, even today, you know, Mascot Towers is half a page in the SMH. So, you know, the issues have been there for years, and I've been kind of banging on about it as well. And I think this has really just pulled the curtains out and said, look, if you have a huge amount of investment stock in one area and the rental market gets hit, it becomes this kind of, you know, diminishing values, you know, the fire sales on rental. And I think that's what we're starting to see now is basically anyone who's renting, you know, if they can get out of not paying rent, because they know that the government's going to basically support them. A lot of renters are just not paying rent. You know, I've been speaking to a property manager this week and she's saying, yeah, some are still earning the same amount, some are getting paid more with JobKeeper and they're just not paying rent because they know that their kind of hands are tied.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, I think all of this creates moral hazard, right? So basically, if people feel that they're getting support from the government directly or indirectly or from the banks directly or indirectly, they probably will push the barrow further than they absolutely may need. And I guess also that you could argue the same about the banks, insofar that the banks are being, to an extent, bailed out by the RBA with its very low rate funding. And so there's a bit of moral hazard there too. I mean, wherever you look, this is very, very complicated. But why don't we just go through the property sector in a little bit more detail? And perhaps we could start with your views on what's happening with listings. It looks to me as though there are some quite interesting movements there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge drop. And I mean, it was obvious that it was going to happen. I mean, one, you couldn't sell because, you know, no open homes, no auctions, the two things in, you know, Sydney, Melbourne that you mainly use. So that, and then also, you know, people just, when things are uncertain, you just stay, right? You don't plan big life events if you're uncertain about your job or what's going to happen, etc. So a lot of people who are thinking about selling didn't sell or pulled their market property off the market just because it was like late March, early April. We had quite a few clients buy for, you know, pretty good discounts on what they would have basically paid 2 months before. And we had a few clients who had bought before they sold. And they were getting, you know, really low-ball offers and they just ended up pulling their properties off the market. So you saw very new properties coming on, but also a lot of properties pulling off the market. I mean, I did a post on it a few weeks ago. A lot of buyer's agents jumped up and said, you know, there's all these off-market sales and, you know, and I don't believe that at all. You know, there might be the occasional one, but, you know, listings have definitely collapsed. Sales volumes have collapsed. But what I think also happened is the quality assets, you know, if you're in a house on a good street, it's, you know, gives you all your lifestyle benefits, got great light, good neighbours, you know, it's a great property. If you're going to upgrade from that, you know you're going to go from this property, you need to be a better property. So the quality assets in times like this just completely vanish. And, you know, for example, a client looking to buy at the moment, he sent me four properties and these are the best he could find. You know, one was extreme south facing dark, one was backing onto a freeway, one had like an L-shaped lock, the other one was next to a creek that probably had mosquitoes and all those sort of problems. So, you know, and these are the best four he could find. So there's just very poor quality stock and very good, small number of good quality properties coming on.
Yeah. Oh, I remember your colleague from the elephant in the room talking about the dog of a property remains of a dog of a property, right? And at the moment, there are lots of dogs about.
Yeah, 100%. And these are the properties that will really struggle. And I think in this old world, it's this new world. And I think this is the really interesting for me at the moment is this work from home movement and how that is going to impact on the property market, because it's definitely something that was a trend, but this has definitely brought that forward a lot and sped it up dramatically. And even though it made common sense, there was something holding it back. And how is this work from home movement going to shift the demand for property? You know, is it going to make it north and south, etc.? And so what I think the worrying part is the people who have got, you know, those dogs, but in good suburbs. So they're expensive, but they don't really offer that many great lifestyle benefits. And they're only supported by people feeling like they have to live in that suburb. So that's why they're paying, you know, let's say $2 million for, you know, an ugly terrace on a busy road in a premium suburb just so they can live there. But if they don't have to live there, do they buy that property? And so I think those properties, the B's and C's that are very expensive in premium suburbs, you've got to be worried about them at the moment just because demand may shift.
Yeah, and I guess that means that those with the really good properties and wanting to buy the really good properties will probably sit on the sidelines for some little time and just see how this all shakes out.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that. I mean, I was chatting to a client this week that, you know, it makes sense for them to upgrade. They want to do it in a really strong financial position. His business is, you know, actually in IT sort of stuff, so he's doing really well as well. But, you know, just the uncertainty, you know, just makes them want to sit still. And even though they, everything's saying they should potentially do it, that just the uncertainty is making them sit still. And so you're exactly right. I think people just don't want to make big financial decisions. And this is the other thing. I think taking on debt, it's sentiment and confidence driven. So if you're going to go and sign up to a mortgage for 30 years and it's got a big number, you want to do that with confidence, knowing that when you sign that contract, you're not going to have all these sleepless nights. And I think the appetite for debt, you know, after, you know, situations like this, is it going to potentially be less? And are we going to want to, you know, people willing just to kind of live a bit more simply? Are they wanting to pay down debt? And that's another big impact on the property market is people's attitudes towards taking on debt. And I think that might shift as well.
Yeah, well, I've certainly seen in my surveys a remarkable change in people's attitude to debt. You know, up until quite recently, because I guess the unemployment was relatively low and, you know, the incomes hadn't grown much, but were actually okay. People felt relatively comfortable with expanding debt because they could see that they could get some benefits from doing it. That's really changed now. They've had a really big wake-up call where suddenly, oh, hang on, my income is less certain than I thought it was. You know, my job is less certain. So I need to be much more careful about, you know, what I'm going to do. And of course, the banks have already tightened some of the underwriting standards quietly in some areas, a little bit more noisily than others. So in fact, people are finding it harder indeed to get those loans in any case.
Yeah, I mean, the banks really went seriously tight about a month ago. I know Macquarie, for example, went really tight really fast. And that was a bit of a wake-up call. It was like, wow, things are really changing. I feel in the last few weeks, there's been very little policy changes. And, you know, we're not really getting decline loans. Occasionally we are for great clients, which is very surprising because that was happening a lot in 2018. And so credit is one of those things. It's credit flow. But the interest rates, like you said about RBA funding line, we're now starting to see variable rates start in the 2.5s. You know, even saw we wanted 2.4. So it's crazy. I think the borrowing capacity issue is a big issue now because, for example, if you're a contractor, can a bank responsibly lend to you if your contract's finishing in 2 or 3 months? Well, probably not. You know, if you're a casual, you know, is there concerns there? Yes. Self-employed, how do you really forecast your business revenue? So a lot of banks are only lending 80% to self-employed where it was, you know, 90. You know, bonuses, you know, can you, if you're working, do you, you know, is a company going to pay out a big bonus this year if their revenue's been hit? Well, probably not. So borrowing capacity, how much people can actually borrow and are out in the market spending, also has a big impact on the market. So that's going to potentially be dramatically reduced. But I think, I mean, even I was just reading this morning, you know, there's already pressure back on APRA. Can you cut your assessment rate? You know, can you reduce it from 2.5% above the current rate to 2%? And so if we're starting to see variable rates at 2.5 plus 2% is 4.5, that's another 10, 15%, you know, maybe not 15%, maybe 10% extra on borrowing capacities. So there's all these sort of, you know, things trying to support the property market, just trying to keep credit flowing.
Well, we'll perhaps come on in a bit second to some of those other initiatives which people are talking about. But I just wanted to touch on first-time buyers because there's some interesting dynamics there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues that was happening in the 2012 to 17 boom is that investors basically completely wiped out first-time buyers. And that's why APRA came in and stopped interest-only lending and investor lending. And, you know, the mum and dads and the, you know, baby boomers were buying the properties and pushing the first home buyers out. And But we have seen first home buyers gradually increase over the last few years. And I think that's obviously a great thing for getting people into, you know, a home if that's what they really want to do. We saw on our end, we saw first home buyers really just pull up, you know, all the pre-approvals a couple of months ago. But, you know, in the last few weeks, we're definitely seeing them back in the market because, you know, whether it's a lifestyle need or a want or, you know, aspiration, you know, they are looking to see this as an opportunity. So I do think a lot of first home buyers are back. The interesting thing is this government grant around the $50,000, which was cooked up by the Property Council. You know, that's coincidental there. They're supporting the construction industry. But, you know, these first home buyer grants and these big things, you know, they basically are not great for the market. They inflate prices and they smash existing homeowners. So it's interesting to see if that gets up.
Yeah, and so did you see the one of the big developers and the HIA both came out and said the industry needs to be more responsible because, in fact, you could be putting people off who might wait to see whether there is going to be another incentive coming in rather than actually transacting at the moment.
100%. It's like, why would you go and buy a new house now? It's potentially 50 grand, which is just a, you know, it's a bit of a kind of fake news story, right? It's just created this belief and people believe that there's, you know, I can't remember who reported it was SMH or maybe all the papers did, but it was like everyone thinks there's this 50 grand coming and there's been no mention of it. It's just the Property Council said it. So
well,
I think
the Master
right.
Builders Association was at 40, I think. I mean, you know, everybody's trying to talk the market up, but in the process, yeah. It's potentially damaging, you know, the immediate intentions of people. And what about the government? Do you think the government's going to expand its own first-time buyer scheme? Because, of course, the first 10,000, you know, loans basically have been allocated now. There's another set coming after the end of the financial year.
I think last week there was still quite a few going around. I think there's still, you know, and they really took off, you know, out of the gates in January. You know, and a lot of people couldn't buy. So they got extended and they got given another 3 months, et cetera, because you had a time frame on it. But another 10,000 is meant to come out in July, I believe. But yeah, I think that's it's one of those things. It's a crazy policy. Maybe they'll bend the rules on that a bit more, you know, remove the income test and maybe allow the purchase price to be a bit higher. So maybe that will help. I think that another thing you mentioned there with the 50,000 grant stopping people taking action. I've had clients also around the belief that, you know, stamp duty is going to go and we're going to move to land tax. And, you know, that's stopping people coming into the market as well. And, you know, that's a huge, huge change. Even though I think it actually makes a lot of sense, it's very hard to get off the sugar that you're addicted to as a government and move to this kind of slow, you know, a little bit each year sort of thing. And I think I don't know whether that's going to happen, but even though it makes sense.
Well, it's interesting because the New South Wales government's just come out with their budget. They're going to be in deficit for the next 4 to 5 years, right? And guess what? One of the really big support mechanisms is stamp duty off house sales. So I'm not sure they're going to be able to give that up and, as you say, take a drip feed over a long period of time because it's going to create a huge budget hole for them.
Yeah, I mean, unless they do something like up GST or something or, you know, something dramatic like that to subsidise it, which, you know, you could potentially see that happening as well, you know, comparing to other countries around the world and what they pay for, you know, service taxes.
Yeah. Well, it certainly could be. But of course, then that the GST is set by the feds and the feds have said, we're not going to change the GST. So interesting discussions there, right? Now,
yeah.
Let me just turn to property investors, because I think this is a really important sector of the market to understand. We're seeing rental streams being squeezed. We're seeing very high vacancy rates at the moment for rental properties. And we're also seeing a lot of Airbnb stuff coming on for long-term rental. So what's going on there?
So you're right. I mean, a lot of investors, I was chatting to a friend who's depreciation business last week, and it just astounds me the amount of investors that still buy new property and have bought new property and new apartments, house and land packages, duplexes in southeast Queensland. You know, we all know they're poor assets, but investors are just going there, their belief there around getting depreciation. And so generally those places where a lot of investors are buying, they're buying where a lot of other investors are going. And so, you know, they're kind of not protected at all. So I think we're not really seeing any investors come back in, you know, whether it's, you don't want to go and kind of leverage up in these times. It's you need to have a lot of confidence in you're doing the right thing, even though it makes sense to be investing when there's less buyers out there. So I just don't think that's really possible. In saying that though, the rates you're getting now for investors is crazy, because the margin difference between owner occupiers and investors and interest only is dropping by the day. And so investors, if they did want to invest, can, you know, basically get, you know, three-year fixed rates under kind of, well, under 3%. So interest only. So it's pretty crazy, but we're not really seeing that back. You know, yes, the vacancy issues. If you've got a house in an area where there's lots of owner occupiers and things like that, the vacancy issues aren't really there because there's not really a lot of investors there anyway, you know? And so I think it's different cases, but the over-leveraged investors who have gone and bought quantity strategy. And when you buy quantity, you generally have to cut your purchase price. So you have to kind of let go of quality a little bit and go in areas like regional areas and outer suburbs. I think the investors who have gone and bought quantity, you know, six properties in, you know, average locations, from a demand point of view, and a supply, I think they're the ones who are really struggling.
Yeah, it's interesting. I surveyed property investors in my survey, and a month ago there were about 8% of property investors signaling they probably would look to sell over the next 12 months or so. That's gone up to 12% in a month. And when you look closely, it's those people with multiple properties, often multiple properties in not very good locations. Back to the dogs question again, right? Or a lot of small apartments. The worst actually of all is Melbourne 3000. That's got the highest number of people saying they're looking to sell. It's got the highest amount of rental stress. And I think that that particular area is going to go through dramatic crunches simply because of the supply-demand disequilibrium. They didn't get the students back, for example, from overseas. There's lots of supply. There's lots of new buildings still going on there. And you can begin to see the nightmare that's building.
The funny thing with Melbourne is I've seen lots of clients with properties in Melbourne, Docklands, South Bank. You know, there's lots of places in Melbourne with oversupply of apartments. The reality is the city's just very flat, and you can just build apartments for fun down there. And you're right, there's so many apartments still going up. I always love when I go down to Melbourne and see family and see clients, and there's always new towers, and that's pretty exciting to look at, but you know that they're not great investments. And the problem with Melbourne apartments is they just haven't gone up. And same in Brisbane, you know, they're just the same price as they were 10, 15 years ago. In Sydney, it's a different problem, I think, and you've got to be a little bit worried because they have gone up. Yeah. And, you know, and they have gone up even though defying the logic of more supply and more demand. It's because of the first home buyers and the foreign investors and the investors. And so, yes, I agree with you. In Melbourne, you know, you've got the Airbnb issue would be a dramatic part on that market. I just think that they've already haven't gone up, and they haven't gone up for a long time. And then you're getting all these supply issues. So you have to think about the investment returns there. If you've invested 10, 15 years ago, and now it's worth a lot less than you paid, and you've then subsidized the cash flow as well for maybe 10, 15 years, you know, that decision has cost a lot of money. And that money's gone. You know, you can't go back. And they're also the opportunity cost. When I look at these investors and I say, look, if you bought a different property, say a quality asset, at that point in time, what's that worth today? And then, you know, that's pretty heartbreaking, because that's the real cost for them, is the difference between making a good decision and a bad one.
Well, we keep saying, you know, go local, understand that not all properties are the same, and just because it's an investment property, it doesn't necessarily going to work. You know, you've got to pick the right place, pick the right investment strategy. And generally, I think your advice would be don't collect a portfolio of very cheap small properties, but actually look for a quality place that's actually got a better long-term prospect.
Yeah, completely get away from the investor market. Get into the home buyer market, where home buyers are buying. And I think the home buyer market, you know, it is split in two. There's aspirational, where people are aspiring because of not just the need of housing, but, you know, the lifestyle benefits, whether that's relationships and families, whether it's, you know, entertaining, whether it's creativity and, you know, space. There's a lot of things that home provide for aspirational sort of lifestyle. But there's also a lot of homes that are built for the affordable space. And the affordable space, you can just keep building for them. That's why they're cheap. And, you know, and that's if you're buying properties that are for the investors, that's the first problem. If you're buying properties for the affordable housing space, I think you'll find problems there, because there's always more supply that can come on there. But the aspirational space, there's generally something constraining it, whether it's the location, whether it's the view or the outlook, or, you know, the kind of the street or heritage overlays, etc. there's something that's generally stopping that market creating more stock. And that's the kind of stuff you want to be buying.
Absolutely good advice there. Now, I want to go on to talk about the down traders. So these are people with a property, they may have a mortgage, and they might be moving into retirement shortly, and they're thinking about the equity in their property. Do you think they should try to sell, or do you think they should try to hold?
It's a really hard one advising that sort of retiree market. It's one of the reasons why I really moved out of that space about six, 7 years ago, is longevity risk is... the movement of, say, your super fund from, you know, higher risk share portfolio to a lower risk, say, more bonds and cash and things like that. When you actually do that, whether you do that at 63 or you do that at 67, it has a huge impact on how long that money will last. And then what happens in that next 5 years? Does stock markets keep going up or do they fall? And that has a huge impact as well. So it's a very hard question to ask. But if you had a quality asset, and you thought, well, actually, you know what, I don't need to sell it right now, I can delay my downsize decision, then I probably would. You know, I probably wait for there's more demand in the market, whether that's net, you know, 6 months, 12 months, I probably wait. If it's a poor asset, you've got to really worry, you know, about the kind of the trends and the impacts after COVID. Unemployment, does that get better overnight? I don't think so. You know, do you think that... you know, that the work from home movement's going to impact things, and does that impact your property? For example, if you're an expensive house in the middle and outer ring, you've got to start to question whether people would purchase a different house if they didn't have to get the train to work every day. So it really depends on the type of property you've got. But yeah, generally speaking, you don't want to sell unless there's a strong demand. And if it's not strong demand right now, then I'd probably wait. But you also have to worry about if there's more supply come on as well.
Yeah, it's tricky. And, you know, I reckon that, you know, the first time buyer decision is a little bit easier because, you know, there are a couple of binary outcomes. But if you're actually a down trader, the equation is just so much more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. And what are you down trading into, and how's that asset going to be affected as well? Because if you've got an asset that potentially is going to be harder hit, you might want to sell now. But if your asset you want to buy is a better quality asset, but if, for example, you want to buy something like a holiday down the south coast or something like that, or, you know, how's that property going to be impacted, you know, or do you sell, rent, go to cash, etc. So it also depends on the asset you're looking to buy, because if that asset's a quality asset, that might actually hold its value. Your asset might fall, and then you start getting this really big impact on delaying your decision.
Yeah, as I say, very tricky. Now, I wanted just to touch on the question of migration, because, of course, we've had very strong migration over the last few years. It's pretty much turned to zero at the moment. I think the Prime Minister indicated perhaps 34,000 migrants next year compared with 200 and something thousand, you know, prior. Do you think that's going to have any impact on the property market?
Yes and no. I think it will be one of our tickets to get out of this, and it generally is what our country's been built on, and we'll continue to try to attract people from all over the world. Does, you know, our results from a health point of view, does our economy get back faster than, say, countries around the world like the UK, US, etc., Europe? You know, are we seen more attractive after this? And we don't know yet. We just don't know. And a lot of that will come down to our economy. But now the lifestyle benefits are still here living in Australia. So I do think long-term Australia will be somewhere where people want to come. And I think that it'll be somewhere that, you know, the government will want to use that money, basically. There's so much money that comes in from migration and tourism. I think the tourism thing will probably get offset. I mean, yes, Queensland and other states are, you know, trying to hold the borders shut. But the reality is they'll open... you know, they'll cave into the pressure, and, you know, and we will travel. Like, you look at the stats, like, we already spend a lot of money domestically traveling. And if we take the money we were going to spend overseas, maybe it won't be as much, but we start to spend domestically. I can see that really support parts of our tourism market. But, you know, the inner rings, you don't really want to go to travel on holidays to Melbourne CBD and look at the tourist attractions. And the same in Sydney. You want to go rural. You want to go places you haven't been before. So I think those tourist areas will probably bounce back better than, you know, the typical sort of hotels in the city.
Yeah, I'm interesting. And I think it's going to be some time before the migrants really start coming back in any numbers. And, you know, there was a lot of noise about Chinese buyers back in the market, or people from Hong Kong back in the market. The data I'm seeing suggests that's really not really happening at all.
There also is the Aussies living overseas. Mm. We've got a lot of people living overseas that we've seen this. You know, clients in, you know, London, Hong Kong, Singapore, etc. US actually as well. Got a guy moving back from Chicago at the moment. You know, do they really want to be living overseas? You know, emotional traumatic events really. I mean, I remember when I was living in London. You know, family is such a big thing. When a family member gets ill, you kind of question whether you want to live there anymore. And I think that's the fear of this situation may start to change attitudes from a lot of Australians living overseas, and you might see them move back. And there's a lot of people overseas moving back. So that might offset a lot of and do you move away in times like now if the economy is around the world? You know, you don't want to move to London right now if unemployment's really high, or the US, or et cetera. And do you move to Hong Kong with all the issues with China? You know what I mean? So I just think, you know, as many Aussies going to leave, and are more Aussies going to come back in the short term? And that can potentially offset, you know, some of this, you know, migration issues.
That's a good point. Well, I think the last topic today I want to touch on is what, let's call it danger zones, right? There is, look to me to be a number of areas where people should be really, really cautious. Perhaps we could just go through some of those.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the high rise market, I've been very sort of worried around high-rise investors for many years. And I just think now it's, you know, you really should have known better now, because it's been going on for so many years in the papers. And, you know, you really should have taken action on not owning these type of properties. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pain, I think, ahead. And it's been there. It's been, the writing's been on the wall. I worry about the house and land packages people who have bought in the last few years. You know, they're got the biggest LVRs. They've got the biggest potentially young families with one person working. If that person loses their job, or the person wants to go back from maternity leave and then there's no job to go back to. So those areas, but especially if this $50,000 grant comes in, the existing stock, why would you buy existing if you could buy new and get 50 grand? The tourism areas that don't bounce back, you know, those areas I think will really struggle. The ones that, you know, Aussies don't really want to go to, but internationals did. Student apartments, I mean, service departments, poor investments. But I think the ones that not really people, it's the in people who have got houses that have paid a lot of money for them that are potentially not great assets. You know, the busy roads, privacy, south facing, dark, etc. I do worry about them, because, you know, I do think those properties are really going to underperform the better qualities in those suburbs, because people are going to be ultra selective. And this is exactly what happened in 2018 when the market came down. The poorer assets got absolutely smashed, and the better assets held their value much, much better and always had competition. So, you know, they're for me are the biggest sort of danger zones.
Yeah, and I'm certainly seeing that in the data on price movements. I was talking to some valuers the other day, and what they're saying is that the quality assets, you know, the houses close in, are actually relatively holding their value. But if you look at some of the other areas where there are lots of apartments or right on the urban fringe, there are already significant down movements there. And I suspect we're going to see that bifurcation even more.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, there's always danger zones, and there's potentially zones that are going to, you know, potentially do better after something like this. And I think the biggest story I'm going to really watch is this work from home movement. Yep. And really start to understand how companies, you know, really come out of this. Now, a lot of companies come up with these great policies, flexible, et cetera, but a lot of companies who would never have gone work from home, you know, design, architects, you know, you can think of lots of companies that potentially they need that collaboration and need to all be there, and they thought they needed it. Well, they had to change. They had to figure out a way to work from home. It forced them to come up with using, you know, this sort of technology. The NBN's been a savior. But those companies, do they continue to have this work from home flexibility? Not just the, you know, the Twitters and the Facebooks, and the tech companies and the banks, you know, but do all companies become work from home? If that's the case, you know, I think that the desire and preferences of buyers will shift. And if that shifts, you might start to see, well, you know, why don't I move an hour north to Central Coast or north of Wollongong, where you are, Martin? That would probably be one of the areas that would do quite well. And, you know, where are those areas potentially where you've got flexibility just to get to the city 2-3 days? And potentially you can even go further than an hour if you have to go 2 days. You know, you potentially could go 2 hours. So then you've got your Newcastles, more your South Coast. And the same thing in Melbourne. Do you live in Mornington Peninsula, Geelong, et cetera? So I think they're the areas that I'd be, you know, watching with this work from home movement.
No, I think that's very interesting. And of course, it also highlights the connectivity question, right? Because I guess the quality of your NBN connection if you're using a landline. You know, do you have fiber to the premise or do you have fiber to the node and therefore you're sharing it with everybody else? I'm fortunate here, we actually have fiber coming right to the premise and we've had no issues at all with the NBN over the last couple of months. But talking to other people who've got the alternative, they've had to switch over to wireless because they couldn't get the connectivity during the day.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, 5G technology is potentially here. Apparently, it caused coronavirus, but you know, I think that's going to save the you know, the internet speed potentially. That's funny. You know, we tried to do this yesterday, didn't we, Martin? And I guess you had an NBN fail. So you're right. I think if you've got, you know, mum and dad, or dad and dad, or mum and mum trying to get on the internet, and you know, plus the kids are on there as well. Potentially you've got problems, which I've heard as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now before we go, the elephant in the room, what's coming up on that?
We've got a few interesting guests. We've got a futurist coming on Tuesday, which is, I'm really going to dig deep on the technology around, you know, and how he's seeing that work from home, because I'm quite fixated on that at the moment. I'm trying to read up as much on it as possible because I think that's probably the biggest story to come out of this. That's an interesting one. We've also got a few on for millennials. Yeah, lots coming on.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to that. And I think the one that I did for you went pretty well. So, you know, it's all good mutual reinforcing stuff.
Yeah, it's great to have you on there, Martin, actually. It's I think a lot of people who are in the property industry become, and this is one of my bugbears at the moment, and I've been very quiet recently on social channels where I usually like to post every day. I haven't come on here because I just don't think everyone's talking with certainty, and you know, in the market and reading in the comments in the papers and things like that. And at this time, there's been immense uncertainty from a health point of view, a global point of view. We didn't even talk about that today, but you know, the global economy is, you know, it's not the US stock market is not the reflection on the health of the global economy. But I think that's been my big bugbear at the moment, is people are looking at things like auction clearance rate and going, well, market's going back up, and very certain on what's going to happen. And I think it's been a time to actually just step back a bit and actually just try to understand things better, because this is a big moment. And at these times, you actually learn the most by actually just potentially taking a step back. And so, yeah, it's good to chat.
Yeah, I appreciate your time today, Chris. And I think your advice there to be a little bit cautious and take your time and think it through is absolutely right, because I think we will look on this last few months as critical, but potentially critical, taking us into quite a new direction, but we won't know what the direction is for quite some time. And therefore, let's assume we're going to bounce back to the old, same old, same old. There could be a whole bunch of new certainties, which won't be certain for some time.
100%. I think, you know, it's the displacement of jobs. You know, there's already enough robots are taking over our jobs and things like that. But the reality is, events like this do make companies innovate, make things go in a whole new direction. Some of the jobs will never come back, etc. And so there's lots of things that we're taking on. And get your information from multiple sources. And that's why we loved having you on the podcast. I was trying to say is that, you know, it's important to have people who are for the market, against the market, in the middle. It's important to really say, otherwise you just get in this vacuum and you just start believing everything you're reading, and it just becomes confirmation bias, and you'll never really truly understand things if you want one dimension, I guess.
Well, it becomes an echo chamber, and unfortunately then you only hear one voice. And, you know, DFA tries to give a little bit of a spectrum too, as you do, and I think that's exactly right. And I keep saying to people, we're not trying to tell you what the right answer is. We're trying to give you a range of information so you can make better decisions, and I think that's probably the way to think about it.
100%. Good to chat, Martin.
Thanks very much. Take care. Talk to you again soon.